Calcio Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the second episode of the week of the Calcio Land Podcast. So today we are going to focus again pretty much just on transfers, but next week we're going to pivot because Serie A is about to begin very soon. So next week we're going to preview this season. It's hard to believe. We'll do one of our favorite segments, the over-under on goals. So that should be fun. Napoli outsiders coming back next week. He'll cover Napoli on the regular part of the podcast. Then we'll take a deep dive on Serie A for patrons. And we have other exciting stuff planned for next week with Serie A starting. But today we're going to talk a lot about transfers. We're going to talk about Inter and Giroud at the top. There's been a lot of buzz on Inter pursuing Conte. Giroud is now the new name for Juve's attack. There are some other hot transfer topics to get to. We haven't done a movie review in ages, and we finally have one today. And we have an excellent segment for our patrons. And to close the podcast, available to all, we have one of our favorite guests, Mark Doyle. We had a fun conversation starting to get ready to preview the Serie A season. But before we get to all that, I am joined by our dear friend, producer, co-host of the podcast, Alex Goldberg. When I emailed him the outline last night for today's podcast, I wrote the transfer gods have been good to us because we have stories that overlap with Chelsea, the Premier League, and Serie A, and we'll discuss at the top. So, Alex, I wanted to ask you a couple of things. There's been reports, both in The Guardian and other areas in the UK, and The Guardian, I think, is definitely very trustworthy, and that Inter is definitely trying to sign Conte, and they offer Chelsea a couple of midfielders, Brozovic or Eriksen. So, Alex, I have two questions. A, are you surprised that Chelsea has no interest in either of those players for Conte? And B, another thing that I wanted to ask you, do you think there is some lingering resentment at Chelsea towards Conte that makes it harder to do deals? I know they did Moses last year, but that, you know, is a little bit different than Conte. Do you think there is some resentment for, like, giving away a really good player to Antonio Conte after his turbulent time at Chelsea?
Yeah, well, you're right that the transfer gods have been good to us, because this question I can answer in my sleep, and that's not to demean your question. This is just stuff I would have been talking about on my end anyway, so it's perfect. So on Brozovic and Eriksen, I'm not surprised at all that Chelsea don't want a player to return. Eriksen, I mean, he's more of an attack-minded midfielder, not like a pure dynamic attacker, but definitely more of a 10, if you will, or an attacking-minded 8. They don't need another one of those. That's for sure. After getting Kai Havertz, they still even have Ross Barkley on the books and Ruben Loftus-Cheek, et cetera, et cetera. So no way to Eriksen. And Brozovic, I know he's a little bit more deeper in the midfield, but still, they don't want any player for that spot other than Declan Rice, who is, even Fabrizio Romano is now tweeting about it after Mendy, the keeper from Rennes, is wrapped up. Declan Rice is kind of the last piece to this big, big window for Chelsea. Let's see if it happens, but certainly that's who they want. So bringing in a player, a midfielder for N'Golo Kanté is not at all what they're trying to do. They're trying to raise cash. They're trying to raise funds. Yeah. So the only reason why Kanté is available at all anyway is the fact that, yeah, he can't get the return that he could have gotten a year or two ago, where it could have been around 100 million, but still, he's 29, and clearly he's just so unique and so special at what he does that he can help Chelsea financially, but they're not just going to willy-nilly get rid of him, and it needs to be enough money. No trying to sweeten the deal or lower the cost by including a player, because Chelsea want Rice. So unless they're going to discuss N'Golo Kanté with West Ham, which is not going to happen, that's just no player swap. So on Conte to Conte, if you will, I'm not surprised at all that there could be a little hesitation from Chelsea to sell a player like N'Golo Kanté to Antonio Conte. And I can confirm, David, there is a reluctance to sell N'Golo Kanté to Antonio Conte. When I saw your outline and I asked a very trusted source of mine, I think he put five zeros there. So like 10,000%. Was my answer on, yes, does Antonio Conte play a part? 10,000% he does. So you're right. It's one thing, Emerson and Victor Moses. It's a whole nother thing to give Antonio Conte and N'Golo Kanté. Now, I'm not saying that if Inter really offered enough money, Marina would say no because all of Chelsea just are that spiteful towards Antonio Conte. No, I don't think it would get that stupid where they would damage their own club just because they're still not in love with Antonio. But if you could write out a list of teams that Chelsea would want to sell N'Golo Kanté to, or managers, shall I say, Antonio Conte will be down near the bottom. So it certainly plays a factor. And it's why that doubled with the fact that are people really going to offer enough for N'Golo? It's why I'm pessimistic on it happening, especially to Inter, because of Antonio. So no players in return, and the money would have to be really sweet for Antonio to get Mr. Conte, which I know can be confusing to anyone listening because they have the same last name. And by the way, they do. I know they're spelled differently, but N'Golo was once asked on how to pronounce his last name, and he did say Conte. He knows that people wanted to say Conte because they didn't want to say the same last name, but it is Conte. So it's Conte and Conte, and it sounds like it's unlikely that they'll reunite. So, David, that's my answer.
Yeah.
And I want to ask you, are you surprised Inter are trying to make so many changes to their midfield?
Yeah, you know, I got to be honest, I am, because, you know, we spend last season very often saying that pretty much all of Inter's midfield could start for Juve and that they were a big step up. And since it was doing really well, I think Barella is one guy that we can, you know, consider a permanent starter at Inter for a while. We were very high on Brozovic on this podcast for a long time. And look, I think for the most part, he had a good season, maybe not great in the second half, but I think a lot of it shifted, you know, especially towards the Europa League run for Inter. We saw Gagliardini starting a lot. We saw Conte definitely trying to go with a more physical midfield instead of, you know, the short guys, Sensi and Barella. Eriksen has had a hard time fitting in. And look, we thought Inter had a pretty stacked midfield even before Eriksen arrived. And it's been kind of hard to fit him in. And it seems now that Inter's really pivoting and trying to make a lot of changes to that midfield that we saw as a big strength for a while. So, you know, we know they're trying to bring in Vidal. They're saying they're going to keep Nainggolan, and more about him later in the podcast. They're going after Kanté, and there's still buzz that maybe Eriksen is available for the right price because they're still not totally sure how he fits in. So yeah, I am pretty surprised that Inter is making so many changes to the midfield, and it might come back to bite them. I totally get why they'd want Conte. I would love, as you taught me now, I would love to see him in Serie A, but yeah, Inter's going to have to raise a lot of money to come up with the transfer fee for Chelsea. And yeah, as if you've been telling me a lot, Rice is definitely a big factor there. But I am surprised that Inter's revolutionizing their midfield. And I got to be honest, I'm not sure if it was totally necessary. Now let's shift gears to Giroud, because last night at the top of Di Marzio's TV show on Sky, they talked about Giroud now being a possibility for Juve for a couple of reasons. For Suarez, we know he has to take his Italian test to get the citizenship. They know that exam has been scheduled for next week, but with Italian bureaucracy, they're just not sure when he'll actually have the citizenship. So there is some concern there. The other big target is Dzeko. And with Zaniolo's injury, Roma's maybe a little bit more reluctant to get rid of Cengiz Under. So Roma would have to pay $35 million to get Milik to replace Dzeko, which would then free Dzeko for Juve. So there's that factor as well. And Cavani, who Juve was looking at, seems to be closer to Atletico Madrid. So Giroud becomes a possibility for Juve. So obviously, Alex, you're very familiar with Giroud. I'm a big fan of him as a player. But I want to ask you, do you see obviously a big drop off from the Suarez Dzeko of the world, or do you maybe even see, looking at Juve, maybe this isn't so crazy that they would be going for Giroud?
Well, if you had asked me that question when he wasn't playing in the first half of last season, I definitely would have thought it was a big drop off. And that's not to say like I forgot that he was serviceable when he wasn't playing. No, I think a lot of fans were saying, hey, why isn't he playing? This guy can still play. He's still France's leading striker. So he definitely has been like a fine wine. This guy has just, Eden Hazard called him the best target man in the world a couple seasons ago. He didn't mean best striker, but he meant exactly what you think when you hear target man. He does his job really well. And of course, Lampard finally did play him in the second half of the season and in the restart, which is the second half of the season. But still, Giroud was just massive in both segments there for Chelsea, and he showed that he absolutely still can play. So when you compare him to a Cavani, a Suarez, or a Dzeko, I mean, on paper, you would think that he has less than those guys. I don't know why, but you would think he has less than those guys, even though they're all north of 30. But I don't actually think it is that big of a drop-off, because the one thing I know with Giroud, David, is if you understand who he is and what type of a player he is, and then you set up your team somewhat accordingly. You don't have to build your team around Giroud, but if when he's on the pitch, you have some people that could cross the ball into him. You have maybe some wingers or midfielders who can play 1-2s with him because he's so good at the hold-up play. Then he's going to be good. Then he's just going to be good. He's never going to be amazing, and it's very doubtful he can give you a full 90. I mean, that's just very doubtful, but he'll be serviceable and solid. So you want to hope for, I don't know, maybe 7 to 11 goals if you play him consistently enough. I think you can get that. And he's great in the dressing room. And I know that's not exactly what you're asking here. You're talking about drop off play wise, but he still brings a lot to the table. Like, this is nobody washed up. And this is somebody, and I'm literally just making this up out of thin air, but this is somebody, if he went to the MLS, you'd look at his age and be like, okay, that's appropriate. But if you looked how he played, you would say, no, too good. Too good. And I know players have gone to the MLS still too good for the league, but he absolutely still should be playing for some top team, in my opinion. So I won't get too much into the rumor itself, because it seems like Chelsea people think he'll stay. Who knows? Who knows? But he's still very good, David. So I wouldn't think it'd be that much of a drop-off. Like, obviously, if Cavani or Suarez have a great game at this point, I think it's better than what a great game is for Giroud, because they just still kind of have that extra element, and perhaps Dzeko as well. But in terms of dependability, I think Giroud is just as dependable as all those guys, if that makes any sense. So that's my answer. And David, let me get your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this. And I'm a big fan of Giroud as a player. You guys know one of my favorite clubs is strikers who bring a lot of value, even when they don't score. And Giroud's definitely a prominent figure in this club. And when I look at Juve, you know, obviously you already have Ronaldo and Dybala, who obviously are superstars and among the, you know, among the very best players in Serie A. And I think Giroud is a player that gives him some good options. Like, he can be that central striker that Ronaldo kind of craves. I think he can also be a bench player. So you give Kulusevski a chance to start a lot on the wings. And I think Kulusevski is absolutely ready to be a starter on Juve right now. I certainly believe that. So when I look at the situation at Juve, and to me it kind of makes sense. Like, obviously Suarez, I'd be very intrigued, but you're bringing in a player at an enormous salary, who's, you know, in already put over 30, well over 30. So there you got a big problem there. We know Cavani is going to have huge demands, and we're not sure if he would play for Serie A club other than the Napoli. So this makes sense. And Juve, you know, has an agreement with, you know, for 2-year deal with a salary under 5 million net. It sounds like they can get him for Chelsea for around 5 million. We know Juve and Chelsea have an excellent relationship. Maybe Chelsea fans think it's pretty one-sided, but they do have a very good relationship. So I have to say, I'm kind of intrigued by this move. And I think, and I think Adam Digby beat me to it. He made a really good point on Kulusevski. And I think ultimately, if you really believe in Kulusevski, and if you don't, I suggest you watch him more. This kind of makes sense in some ways. So I kind of like this move more than my what my initial reaction was, because my initial reaction was like, geez, you know, this sounds like a really big drop off from their other targets. So I think this could actually work out. I think Juve too is going to wait a little bit, see what happens with Suarez, see what happens on the Dzeko front. I would say that that's still their first choice. But if it doesn't work out, they can get Giroud on this good deal.
Okay, very interesting. Well, David, let's move it right along to hot transfer topics, and it just feels so hot these days, so let's get right to it. What do you make of Diego Godin leaving Inter to join Calgary?
Yeah, this was really another very surprising transfer, and this isn't done yet. We have to see if Godin wants to move to Sardinia, obviously. Think about just when he was on Atletico Madrid and you said, look, within 2 years, this guy's going to be playing at Cagliari. I think my head would have exploded. And it's interesting because I think Godin finished the season very strong. He had finally adapted to Conte's three-man back line. But I think there's a couple of factors. A, he has an enormous salary, over $5 million, which for Cagliari would be tough, but last year they worked out a deal with Inter with Nainggolan, who had a comparable salary, so maybe it's a repeat of that. We know Inter and Cagliari have a great relationship. Their president, Giulini, used to be a board member on Inter. And Godin has that huge salary, which Inter would be happy to get off the books. And I wouldn't imagine there would be a big transfer fee, if any, but maybe they can also make a plusvalenza since he was a Bosman signing. So interesting there. Let's see how this evolves. You know, what's interesting to me about this Godin news is I see a lot of potential dominoes here. So A, I asked myself, does this mean that Kolarov is going to be almost certainly a center back at Inter? Does this mean that Skriniar is off the market now? Would they move both Godin and Skriniar? Would Inter go back in on Kumbula, who now seems to be closer to Lazio? Another player that's been that Inter had some control over was Van Hootsen, who was that center back that was sold for a huge fee that raised a lot of eyebrows with plusvalenza last summer, but I've heard is a pretty intriguing player. And then the other one, and this is probably pushing it a little bit, is I wonder if Acerbi becomes a possibility for Inter. He's had issues extending his contract with Lazio. He changed agents. He's now with Pastorello, who is doing a ton of deals with Inter. So what's interesting to me about Godin potentially leaving Inter, and what a signing that would be for Cagliari, by the way, is the domino effect on the other potential center backs at Inter. So Inter to me is a really fascinating team these last few weeks of the transfer window.
Very interesting. All right, David, how big of a role will Nainggolan and Perisic have at Inter next season?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that both of them, two players that they went out of their way to get rid of last season, you know, are coming back. And I think they're coming back in a lot of ways rejuvenated. Perisic definitely was a factor in Bayern Munich, you know, winning the Champions League. I think he played well. Nainggolan definitely had a comeback season at Cagliari. He looked like a lost player. And look, put it on the surface, if they can kind of confirm their season from what they just showed us in the previous campaign next year, those are really good additions for Inter. But I still have a feeling at least one of them will be sold. Could Perisic now all of a sudden be that winger in Conte's system? They tried last year. It didn't really work. And he be kind of a second striker, so a backup to Lautaro, potentially. But that's a pretty big salary. So I'm still not totally sold. And Nainggolan as well. You bring in Vidal. Those are pretty similar players. But, man, Inter's midfield all of a sudden looks very different from last season as well. So I'm pretty intrigued. But I still believe at least one of these two is going to be sold.
Okay. David, were you surprised Atalanta closed the deal for Pacini?
Yeah, absolutely, because last Tuesday we were talking about Zappacosta being almost certainly the new Atalanta wingback. They bring in Pacini, who was the player that Mancini started for Italy that a lot of us were kind of puzzled. Should be a pretty intriguing move for Atalanta, but I don't know where this leaves Zappacosta. He had been linked to Fiorentina. I'm sure he doesn't have a role at Chelsea, so I expect him back on a Serie A team, but it won't be Atalanta. So yeah, I'm surprised they signed Piccini, but I'm pretty intrigued by the move.
All right. How likely is Chris Smalling to return to Roma, David?
Yeah, I would say pretty much certain. He's really pushing to go back. I think really the question is on what formula does he return? You know, I kind of see Smalling a little bit like Jorginho. I would kind of weather expectations for Man United fans on what the return is going to be for him. Would it shock me that they extend the loan? No. Or if Roma buys him, I'm sure they would pay it over multiple years, but I wouldn't expect it to be more than 15 million. But at this point, I'd be really surprised if he's not on Roma. The question is on what formula.
This is a player that, honestly, I have forgotten about. David, do you see El Shaarawy returning to Italy?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, in a way, yeah, I could see why people would forget him. But interestingly, who hasn't forgotten about him is Roberto Mancini, who keeps calling him to Italy. So this is kind of interesting that the reason El Shaarawy is available, and he's technically available on loan through January of next year, is that, you know, he's playing these games with Italy. By the time he goes back to China and have to go through the quarantine, there would only be one game left for Guangzhou, his club. And then he'd have to come back because Italy plays a game in October again, another international break then. So they're like, you know what? It just makes sense to loan you out to Europe till then. Now El Shaarawy would run back to Roma. He loves it there. I think he might actually still have a house there. But he could be intriguing with the Zaniolo injury, and maybe he makes Under available for the Milik deal, so he kind of ends that domino effect there with Zeko. So pretty interesting. I know he's also been offered to Arsenal, which could be pretty intriguing. PSG, they have Leonardo, who's familiar with him. There's been a little bit of buzz on Juve with El Shaarawy, so I'm intrigued. I love El Shaarawy, not just because he played at my favorite team, Padova, but also because I just like the way he plays. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Maybe Italy, not certain, but I definitely expect him in Europe, at least through the fall, and then maybe that loan deal becomes a permanent deal.
Okay. All right, David, what can Inter Miami expect from Gonzalo Higuain?
Well, I'll tell you one thing for certain. What they can expect is that after this move, fair or unfair, they are going to be the club that every fan is going to have on the tip of their tongue when they have a veteran player they want to get rid of who's not living up to his wages. Because Matuidi, I still think he's a good player, and I think Matuidi still could have had a role at Juve next season, so I don't think he's washed up. You add him. Then on top of that, you bring in Higuain, who, sorry, I think is absolutely done as a player. And it was very interesting to see, you know, I asked how do you grade his time at Juve or how do you grade his acquisition for Juve? And he has more supporters than I figured he would. But in any event, I think he's really kind of washed up now. I think what we saw at Chelsea and what we saw at Juve this season is really the player that he has become. I get that he's still a big name and maybe in Miami, kind of a marketable person to get people to the stadium. But I don't know. I think now Miami has branded themselves as the club Serie A fans are going to have in mind every time they want to get rid of a veteran who earns way too much.
Okay. All right, David, last one for this segment. Have you seen any good movies recently?
Yeah, it's been way too long since we did movie reviews or talk pop culture. So I figured I'd sneak one in. And I did see a great movie recently. It's called Boy State, and it's the best reviewed documentary of the year so far. I heard about it on a podcast that I really loved, The Big Picture with Sean Fennessy. Really, really great podcast. It's on Apple TV Plus, so I decided to get it at least for a month. There's also the Beastie Boys movie on there, which is quite good. There's some pretty cool stuff on there, but I got it just really for Boy State. You guys know I'm a political junkie, and Boy State is about this week-long political camp for teenagers. It takes place everywhere in the U.S., definitely in multiple states, but this one in particular in Texas. In the past, there were figures like Bill Clinton, Rush Limbaugh, other very prominent figures, both politicians and people that cover politics have gone to this camp. So it's very popular, and it's about these kids, these teenagers who are at this camp, and they run to be the governor of the camp. There's two political parties. There's they have elections for party chairs to kind of be the strategist for the general election when these two parties have each a candidate to be the governor. And this documentary is really outstanding. The teenagers that they chose to follow was great. Obviously, there's like a lot of teenagers. I think hundreds of teenagers participate in this ahead of time. They picked a few to follow, and they picked really, really well, some fascinating characters. And really, in a lot of ways, this documentary explains a lot of the political situation here in the U.S. The two characters that really stand out at me are Ben Feinstein, who starts the movie holding a Ronald Reagan action figure, and he's a diehard Republican. And he becomes the party chair. He quickly realizes he's not charismatic enough to be a governor candidate, but he's a behind the scenes, really Machiavellian figure. Ben, fascinating character. And then the other, the star, I would say, of the documentary is Stephen Garza, who, if down the road he runs for president or even becomes president, it absolutely would not shock me. The documentary is mainly about his journey, and at one point he gives a speech that is incredibly inspiring, especially when you've watched the movie and you see how he built up to it. So I really strongly recommend it if you enjoy politics, if you enjoy great documentaries, if you enjoy fascinating characters. It's definitely worth it. You know, maybe you get Apple TV Plus for 1 month to check this out, the Beastie Boys and the other stuff, and you cancel it after that. But I definitely think Boys State is worth it. Another thing that at least I hope is worth it is being a patron of Cultureland. If you enjoy all the free content on the podcast, we have a lot more. With Patreon, our patrons get to ask us questions for the podcast. They get the longer version of the podcast where we answer those questions. They almost every week we have a bonus interview. We had a bonus interview with Enrico Passarella. Next week we'll have a long bonus interview with Napoli Outsider, who once a month is on Patreon with us. And we have some excellent articles as well. Okay, I'm very excited. One of the best parts of having a podcast is you get to become friendly with great guys like Mark Doyle. I've interviewed Mark quite a few times. Carlo Garganese, a while back, told me you need to interview Mark. The two of you will hit it off well, and he was absolutely right. So I was talking to Mark. We both can't believe the season is almost here, so I figured today we talk a little bit about the main storylines with Mark, who is a features editor at Goal and one of my favorite writers on Serie A. So, Mark, as always, a real pleasure to chat with you. Bentornato to Calcioland.
Thanks very much. No, it's always a pleasure to chat football with you, as you said. And I'm thrilled to be back. As you said, it seems weird to be talking about a new season already, but I'm looking forward to it at the same time.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, everything is a little bit different this year, and things are very different at Juve. So let's start here, since they are the defending champions. So a little bit of time has passed since Juve's very surprising appointment of Pirlo. But what do you make of the club transitioning out of the Sarri project after 1 year and handing the keys to Pirlo, that has no experience? But of course, that Juve kind of DNA in him now. What do you make of that switch?
I found it surprising. I still kind of find it surprising. Probably like many, many Serie A fans, still trying to get used to the sight of Pirlo as the Juve manager. It just feels strange. It doesn't feel that long ago since he was actually kind of playing for Juve as well. So, there's two elements that have kind of shocked me about the decision. The first was obviously that they abandoned the Saudi project, as you said, after one season. I thought by appointing a guy like that they were at least going to give him two seasons, that they were committed to his style of play, his philosophy, which, as we know, takes some time to get used to, takes some time to bed in. And you're also going to get backlash against it, as we saw at Chelsea. I think it's been pretty evident that with someone like Sarri, the success he had at Empoli and then Napoli, maybe at, for want of a better word, smaller clubs, you get more time. Not that, you know, Napoli is obviously a massive club as far as I'm concerned, but I think that maybe the pressure was less intense there and people were more willing to go along with what he was trying to do. I think they were certainly more understanding of the style of play that he was trying to implement and that it would require a bit of patience. He certainly didn't get any patience at Chelsea. I thought he was treated terribly there by the fans in particular, who were very, very quick to turn on him. I thought at Juventus, again, I just found there was a real lack of patience in what the guy was trying to do. I have a lot of time for him. I also acknowledge that when you're managing clubs of that level, they not only demand success, they demand that you play well. But again, I found that contradiction. That's what Chelsea are. That's what Juventus in particular were trying to move away from. They wanted to add style to their substance, which we know they've had because of how many titles they won. And they wanted to show that it wasn't just winning wasn't the only thing that counts, which is obviously the mantra at Juve. But
yeah,
even when he won the title, he won the Scudetto, and he kind of thought maybe that would be enough. And there were, he was given very public assurances that he would still be the coach next season, and that it all wasn't going to come down to one defeat or one loss. And it pretty much did. It came down to the elimination at the hands of Lyon, which was admittedly shocking. I myself was very critical of that loss and how it even came to the point where their performance in the first leg, I suppose, was a kind of like a microcosm of the season, that they were so poor. It was possession without any penetration. They lacked ideas. It was a really kind of dismal performance and kind of summed up how they performed for the most part of the season. So I understand he had to be held accountable for the general malaise there that was evident throughout the whole season. I could probably only think of two or three performances off the top of my head that in which I thought, okay, Juve are actually playing well. Juve look formidable. The Inter game in particular, the derby d'Italia behind closed doors, I thought, okay, they're looking good. Maybe we're starting to see what Sarri is trying to do. So I can appreciate all that, that there were issues. Maybe the players were never 100% on board as well, but I did think he would be given another season. So I found that shocking. Then, as you say, for them to turn to a complete novice was a staggering move. I saw people compare it to the Guardiola situation at Barcelona all the way back in 2008 when they needed a complete overhaul and they returned to a guy who had, you know, Barca DNA. You're talking about Juve DNA as well. So, however, I think there's a big difference there. Guardiola had a season as a Barcelona B coach. He had some coaching experience. And he also knew then the club. He knew exactly what was going on in the club. He knew exactly what was going on in the first team and what needed to be changed. So the guy was right there the whole season and also was all the while getting experience. I've seen people compare it to Zidane. Zidane was groomed for the Real Madrid job. Like he had been taken under the wing, under Carlo Ancelotti's wing. He was the Castilla coach as well. So I think it's important to draw a big line between those. Like they're not starting from the same position. Pirlo is starting from absolutely ground zero. Like he's come in with no experience whatsoever. He even said himself when he got the under 23's job that, okay, this is the perfect kind of way for me to learn my trade. And then all of a sudden, what, 2 weeks later, he's in the top job. So it's ballsy. It's a hell of a gamble. We know the fans love him. I get that. I love him too. And, you know, for everything he did as a player. And then just the whole persona, that the aura that Pirlo has around him that's been cultivated around him for years. It's very attractive and very, very seductive. But I still find it a staggering decision. And Let's see what's going to happen. It's going to be very, very interesting, particularly if they don't hit the ground running, to see how much time and patience he's supported. I certainly hope he gets more time and patience than Sarri was given. Otherwise, it could be a disaster.
Yeah, very well said. So one up, as we're recording, and we're recording Thursday morning, you guys will hear this on Friday, and over the weekend, Juve is looking at two strikers. Luis Suarez, who has to pass his Italian test, then has to get a buyout from Barcelona, and Edin Dzeko, who seems to be a player that Pirlo especially seems to be quite intrigued by. What do you make of Juve being linked to these two? And if you could pick one to join Ronaldo and Dybala up front, who would it be and why?
The first thing I want to say, I'm a massive, massive fan of Luis Suarez as a player. I genuinely think he would be regarded for me as the best striker of the past decade. That's how highly I rate the guy for what he did at Liverpool, for what he did at Barcelona. I would argue that, yeah, he's a modern great. There's no getting away from that. I think he's still incredibly inventive. I think he's technically excellent. But Juve lacks pace, as far as I'm concerned, up front. And Suarez, I don't think, has any left. I think he scored a great goal, as we saw, against Bayern Munich. I think that was all down to his ingenuity and his speed of thought, his quickness of mind. But I think his lack of pace was painfully evident in the very same game. At one point, he tried to chase the true ball, in which he had a head start on over Alaba, and was just rapidly chased down. So I think that's been a problem at Barcelona. From having watched a lot of Barcelona over the past few years, Suarez's decline has been evident and difficult to watch for someone who's such a big fan as I am of his skill set. I think one of the main problems that Barcelona have had actually is that they haven't properly replaced him, and that's why they were obviously pushing so hard to sign someone like Lautaro Martinez. I don't think he can press like he used to. The guy used to be a force of nature in that regard. He was like a one man. You know, you talk about you're the defending starts from the front. And Suarez embodied that. I think he was like a one man forward line in that sense. I don't see guys like Ronaldo pressing. I'm not sure if Dybala is particularly adept at it either. So I don't see him as a great fit. I think he could score goals in Serie A, but in Europe, where Juve really wants to succeed, is he going to help them win the Champions League? I don't think so, because let's face it, he hadn't scored outside Camp Nou in about 4 years before he got the goal in Lisbon against Bayern. So I don't see him as the answer in that regard. And I don't see much sense in replacing one guy in Higuain, who's, you know, 30-something and past, and clearly his best years are behind him. With all respect to Higuain, I don't see the sense in replacing him with another 30-something whose best years are behind him. So again, I acknowledge that in advance that Dzeko is the wrong side of 30 as well. But if I had to choose, I'd choose him, because I think he's very underrated still. I think he scores goals wherever he goes. He already knows what Serie A is all about. And he still looks formidable to me when he's fully fit. So I can understand why Pirlo is more drawn to him or is considering signing him as well. I think that Dzeko, to me, even though the age problem is all wrong, if we're trying to rejuvenate this Juve team, it doesn't make sense in that regard. But If I had to choose between the two, I would definitely go with Dzeko at this point.
Yeah, very interesting. Like you, I'm intrigued by the Suarez thing, but I lean more towards Dzeko for the reasons that you mentioned. Okay, let's transition to Inter. I was trying to find a good question to ask you. I mean, we'll get to Tonali in a second, but I want to ask you just in general right now, as we're recording, based on what we know about Juve and Inter right now, who do you think is the favorite? You think Inter deserve to be the favorites for the Scudetto, probably mainly because of the uncertainty at coaching at Juve and the improvement of the squad? Or do you still think Juve, because of winning so many titles in a row, deserve to be the favorites right now?
Yeah, it's well put. That is the crux of the issue. I do make Inter favorites because I think, as you've alluded to, there's a lot more certainty surrounding Inter, particularly after those showdown talks with Conte and Zhang, and they kind of, it seems like they've got everyone on board now, and they've given Conte not everything he wanted, but maybe a lot greater control, and the situation seems to have stabilized and calmed down significantly, because at one stage it wasn't certain that he would stay. So I think we know what Inter are trying to do. We know what Conte is trying to do. We've seen how much they improved last season. They're clearly, in my opinion, on an upward trajectory. I think they're a serious threat for next season. I think they finished the season well. Obviously, the Europa League final didn't go. It showed they still have limitations. They still have issues to resolve in the field. But to me, it's a team that I think we know what we can expect from them. I don't know what really to expect from Pirlo's Juventus this season. I'm not entirely sure how they'll line up. We don't know how they'll respond as a dressing room to Pirlo, the coach. You know, we know obviously Pirlo, the player, commands immediate respect. You imagine that would stand him in good stead with a group of superstars. He's spoken briefly, but not maybe in depth about, you know, what he wants to do. You know, possession is obviously going to be key to him. He wants the team to work hard. He wants to win. You know, he's kicking all the boxes in that sense. But until he actually, you know, get on the field and we can actually see them playing and see what noticeable differences there will be for last year. I thought it was interesting that he, you know, Pirlo himself has spoken of his admiration for Sarri and spoken of his admiration for his principles as well. So it'll be very interesting to see tactically how they line up this season. And that for me, because of that whole uncertainty, I'm not, you know, Juve could hit the ground running, Pirlo could prove, you know, as intelligent and innovative as he was as a player, you know, he could prove just as fantastic as a coach. So, but until we know that, I would be tipping Inter at this stage, just because it's the more settled side for now. Obviously, Conte could blow up at any moment and start complaining again, and it could all kick off. But for now, I'm going to go with Conte's Inter.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think we need to see a little bit about Pirlo and make sure he's not Ciro Ferrara 2.0. So now let's talk a little bit about Tonali, which you recently wrote about, as usual, really, really well. So let's look at it by two angles. A, how much do you think he can help Milan right away? They have an intriguing midfield that he joins. And B, do you think there's a chance that Inter has a Zaniolo-like regret? And I'm going to say a Zaniolo-like regret before he tore his knee for the second time, unfortunately. But even with two ACLs, it's rough. So look at it from both those angles, how he fits at Milan and the possibility of a big regret for Inter.
Yeah, as you said, I was asked about a piece about this, about the deal in general, and I would speak often in support of Conte. I do think he's doing a good job there. I think the progress is obvious. You just look at the points total of how they've increased since he took over and that kind of thing. But this is a huge, huge gamble on Conte's part to basically, and Inter in general, to ignore one of the most exciting midfielders to come along in Italy in years, as far as I'm concerned. When you watch Tonali, like you just kind of think, okay, this kid has it. You know, he just looks so at home in Serie A and so comfortable. And the guy is 20 years of age, and you just think this is a guy who could be around for, you know, the next 10 years running midfield, you know, both at club level and international level. So obviously you don't want to get too excited, but the potential is obvious. The talent is there for all to see. So for Inter to kind of move away, decide that, okay, let's go with someone like Arturo Vidal instead, like at 33 years of age, is a hell of a gamble, and it's a hell of a decision to make, because it basically means you're prioritizing instant success over long-term gain. And that means you have to win. I think that Inter have to win this season. I think they'll be under incredible pressure. I mean, just look at the reaction of the fans. Inter fans were furious about this, that they've essentially gifted this potentially generational talent. Not only have they, you know, rejected the chance to sign him, they've gifted them to their city rivals. So it has the potential for backlash is enormous. It'll be one that Conte, it could define his tenure in a way, because it kind of symbolizes or illustrates the fact that he wants to win now straight away rather than trying to build something long term, which, you know, he's not a coach maybe that stays around too long, because he's so intense, because he's so demanding. So it's a double-edged sword with him. The reason why he's so successful is probably because he's so driven. But at the same time, he can be very difficult to work with over a long period of time. So I think I can understand why Inter fans are concerned, why they're a little bit, disillusioned with, and I'm wondering why they passed up the opportunity to sign this guy. Because as you alluded to as well, he's going to be walking into a Milan team that has a number of interesting and exciting young players. There's a real buzz about them, about the club. I can understand why the fans are excited about this season, because, you know, Milan finished last season so strongly and things were seemingly coming together, and they added, you know, you gotta give a lot of credit to Maldini. I think he's made some really shrewd signings, you know, and not just young players either, David. Like, even just the Ibrahimovic move, which I was really skeptical about. I thought, okay, this just shows the desperation. Yes, he might do well, but it just shows where Milan are at. And fair play to Ibrahim, which has had an incredible effect on a side that needed that kind of experience and maybe that winning mentality as well. So Kjaer, another one that he brought in, another really smart move. And there's a lot of these like low-cost moves, but also they're also bringing in younger guys. Theo Hernandez was a deal that I know that Maldini was really heavily involved in. The guy's been fantastic. So I think I'll always say again, no matter where your loyalties lie in Serie A, it is a much better league, and it is much better for every team in the league when you have the likes of Milan back up near the top, Inter, and you know, everybody wants a competitive league. That's what we were so excited about, Atalanta and Lazio joining the party as well. Everyone wants to go back to the days where you had the Seven Sisters all, you know, competing every season and all packed with quality players. So I think it's as a signing, as I tried to argue in the piece, that could actually restore a bit of balance, because for me, it immediately makes Milan a better, stronger side. And it makes them a side that's more likely to be challenging for the top four next season. And I very much look at it as that, to go back to the original point, is that Milan's, or Inter's loss could be very, very much Milan's gain. And that could be a good thing for the league in general in terms of overall balance and competitiveness.
Yeah, very well said on Maldini. And I'll even add to that, on top of that, he also got rid of some of his unwanted players, got rid of a lot of the payroll, and a lot of other teams would have really struggled with that. So I totally agree. I think right now, Maldini, if I had to name the winner of the summer transfer window, it would be him without a doubt. And taking Tonali from under Inter's nose, and granted, we know Inter didn't have the money, but still, it could be really, really a great move. So I agree there. Let's look at the two teams that were in the top four last season. I want to ask you, who is more likely to clinch a Champions League spot again between Lazio and Atalanta, in your opinion?
It's a tough question. I think it's going to be very close. When they both have their very best players on the field, I don't think there's much to choose between them. I think they're two very strong starting 11. My issue with, my concern, I suppose, with Lazio is whether they have the strength and depth to cope with playing twice a week, and particularly the rigors of Champions League football as well. I think we saw, and it's something we touched on before, we were both absolutely delighted, obviously, to see Lazio up challenging. But the concern was always when the schedule got so compressed as it did post lockdown, and we saw then the damage that it did to the squad, and Lazio's title challenge was pretty much decimated with injuries. They just did not look like the same side post lockdown as they had beforehand. And in many ways, coronavirus had probably put paid to their hopes of winning this Scudetto. So that'd be my issue. In that, okay, Atalanta, they have a massive budget, as we talked on Netflix before, but as we saw last season, they had like a 12th man, a 13th man, a 14th man, a 15th. There were so many guys who were coming into the squad and were coming off the bench that were making a difference. You know, it wasn't just like Lewis Moreau with all the goals he was scoring as well, but like even someone like Dandy coming in as well. It was really impressive to see how, and I think it was the effects of a squad and a philosophy that's so deeply entrenched, and a project that's been running for so long under Gasparini, that pretty much, you know, these guys were coming off the bench, and the whole squad is they're all moving in the same direction, and they all know, they're all completely convinced of their roles, and they're all 100% sure of what they have to do. I'm not saying for a minute that Inzaghi hasn't done a great job down at Lazio, and it's also fantastic that they've managed to hold on to the likes of Milinkovic-Savic, which I would not have predicted at the start of summer at all. So they will be strong again, and obviously Immobile's got the new deal and stuff like that. So, but I just, yeah, on the evidence of last season, one of those sides is well equipped to deal with, or better equipped, let's say, to deal with playing twice a week. And I don't think it's Lazio, unfortunately. I think if I had to back one of them to finish in the top four, it would be Atalanta. And that's despite the fact that Papu is a year older. There's been a lot of unfortunate uncertainty surrounding Ilicic. But I think Gasparini's core beliefs are entrenched in that squad. And I think that's what will hopefully sustain this incredible run of success for another season.
Yeah, you know what? It feels like, you know, Atalanta has a lot of positive momentum, you know, great storylines. Yeah. They did well in the Champions League. Lazio, on the other hand, feels like a team that has a lot of negative momentum. But you look at their moves, they've done, both of them, I think, have done well on the transfer market. But it feels like Lazio, there's more potential for a hangover season, right? Like, before the pandemic, they had a chance to win the title, and that was slipped. The rug was slipped from under their feet. So I could see the potential for a very negative season at Lazio, a little bit similar to Napoli after they didn't win the title against Juve, coming so close. Briefly on Roma, I wanted to ask you this. It looks like Smalling is returning to the club. Like, how important do you think it is for the team to get it over the finish line and get Smalling back at Trigoria?
Yeah, I think it's huge. I think he was one of the signings of last season. I thought he was absolutely fantastic, given, you know, we were talking about, you know, having doubts, and there were so many doubts surrounding Smalling after a pretty difficult period of his Manchester United career. So I thought he was fantastic last season. I thought he made a big difference to them. I thought at one point it was looking like he wouldn't return. I thought that was going to be such a shame because Smalling to Roma, I see, is kind of one of those very rare deals that it suits everybody. They obviously have about five or six centre backs. They need to offload someone. They could do a little bit of cash is always welcome, particularly in these times. Roma needed a centre half who had delivered so consistently for them last season. And for Smalling as well, he seems determined to go to Roma. It seems like that they were the only club he wanted to sign for. He didn't seem to be entertaining any other ideas or potential destinations. So I just see it as a kind of win-win-win in a way. And I think it would be again at Roma. You're looking for. There's been a lot of uncertainty. Obviously, the ownership issue is resolved now, and it's just they want to see decent signings being made. They don't want to lose any. Obviously, the Zaniolo thing is really depressing for them as well at the moment, and for everybody concerned. It's just any fan of football would be devastated by that. So, they kind of need a bit of a boost at the moment. So I think Smalling, okay, it's not the most spectacular name in the world or whatever, the most famous name, but I think it would be just such a solid addition and such a nice boost for the team going into the new season.
Absolutely, yeah. And I agree with you. It really is a deal where everyone benefits if it goes over the finish line. Okay, I wanted to ask you about two coaching changes that I thought were pretty intriguing. Teams that are somewhat similar. I think Cagliari is a little bit more ambitious, it's fair to say. But which coaching move do you think has a better chance of working out? Liverani replacing Daversa, who had done well at Parma, or Di Francesco going to Cagliari after they went through the Maran Walter Zenga carousel last season?
They could certainly do with a bit of stability. All right, I'm interested to see. Actually, I'm very interested to see how both of them work out. Di Francesco, obviously, as we know, had done so well previously, and I was a bit unfortunate at Roma as well. I kind of thought a bit of looking. Subsequently, had a very, very difficult time at Sampdoria. It will be interesting to see how he does with a squad that has some interesting players in it. And for a while last season, particularly during the first half of last season, thought like it looked like they might actually be able to do something, at least maybe challenging for a Europa League spot or something like that. So it'll be fascinating to see, how he goes there as well. As you said, they're a little bit more ambitious. Maybe there's a bit more expectations being placed upon him, particularly because he had such a stellar reputation going back to his days at Sassuolo. And again at Roma he got them to the semi-finals of the Champions League as well, so there will be maybe a bit more pressure on him. If I were to back though, someone maybe to make a bigger impact, I'm really kind of hoping and optimistic about Liverani doing something at Parma, because they've lost Kulusevski, who was such a big player for them, and he's obviously gone to Juventus. But there's an interesting group of players there, and also I really enjoyed watching Lecce last season, and I thought they were a bit unfortunate to go down. I thought they were always they defensively maybe they were caught out at times and they struggled, and that was very much their Achilles heel. But I did always enjoy watching them play. And obviously, he did a great job, getting them up to Serie A as well after a couple of incredible seasons. So that's one I'm most looking forward to. And that's maybe if trying to pick a surprise of someone that actually might exceed expectations this year. Maybe that'd be the one I'd go for.
Absolutely. Well, I can't thank you enough, Mark. It was a lot of fun to get ready for the season with you. I definitely, if you enjoyed listening to Mark, and how could you not love that accent and his knowledge of Serie A, check out his work. I love that Mark is based in Italy, so he's close to the action. He recently wrote about Tonali. Really great stuff. Check out all his work on Goal. So, Mark, thank you so much for joining me. Good luck with the season, and I look forward to chatting with you about all the great storylines in calcio in the months to come.
Right back at you, David. Thanks very much. It's always a pleasure, mate.